You're listening to Free City Radio. This is the 199th edition of the program. I'm Stefan Christoff, recording this from Mexico City. On the broadcast today, I'm going to be sharing a conversation that I had with Aisha Vemuri, who is a co-editor of a book called Solarities, Seeking Energy Justice. It's described this way: Solarities considers the possibilities of organizing societies and economies around solar energy and the challenges of a just and equitable transition away from fossil fuels. Far from presenting solarity as a utopian solution to the climate crisis, it critically examines the ambiguous potentials of solarities, plural, situated, and often contradictory. I found this project interesting for a number of reasons. One is that it's collectively written. There are two editors, Aisha Vemuri and Darren Barney, but there is many contributors, so I like that collective aspect of the work. But also, I think it really visits in a complex way some of the major challenges that we face right now all across the world, which is the transition from fossil fuels. What does that actually look like technically? What are projects that can unfold that not only challenge this dependency on fossil fuels, but also seek to have a different alignment of political, social, and cultural organization? How we organize society has been so shaped by this dependency on fossil fuels, and that is, of course, tied to a colonial capitalist framework. So what does social organization look like beyond fossil fuels? And Solarities is an interesting project, this book, because it looks at this. So I'm happy to share this conversation with Aisha here on Free City Radio. Here it is.
So I'm Aisha Vemuri. I'm a PhD candidate in communication studies at McGill University. And the reason I'm here is because I co-edited this book, this little book called Solarities, Seeking Energy Justice. I edited it along with my supervisor, Darren Barney, but the book itself is authored by the After Oil Collective, which is a group of academics, activists, practitioners of various kinds, so artists, journalists, and so on, who came together a few years ago in 2019 to around something called After Oil School. And so quickly, the After Oil School is something that's organized by the Petrocultures Research Group, which is a scholarly project that people who work on on oil in one way or another, oil in society, oil in politics. There's a big conference called the Petrocultures Conference every 2 years. So in the off year, they started to think about what it might look like to think about life beyond petrocultures, right? So the After Oil One was the first experiment, but apparently it ended up focusing a lot on petroculture because it was hard to get away from it. So for the second one, which Darren decided to organize here in Montreal, they decided to kind of provisionally nominate solar as one possible life beyond petrocultures. So what would a world that, you know, where solar energy was the primary energy source look like? What kinds of problems or affordances does that bring us? What kind of material like shifts need to happen? What kinds of, you know, infrastructural transformations or social transformations, economic transformations, cultural shifts need to happen in order for solar to become the primary fuel, as well as what happens once it already is, right? Like what does that world look like? Those are the kind of like the big question around which we gathered, and then we invited after the group itself, like the school itself, was many conversations, and then once the little summer school ended, we invited all the participants to submit a short reflection responding to one of three prompts, right? I don't remember the prompts right away, but like I think one of them had to do with scale, another had to do with politics, and a third was just a sort of an open thing that people could submit a reflection on solar energy. And so we got about 50-something responses, and then Darren and I, worked together to compile them into something like a singularly authored text. We ran the text by all the people who submitted multiple times to make sure that they were happy with it, because when you have 50 different authorial voices, you have to edit quite a bit to change it. So out of that came this little book that is published by the University of Minnesota Press. They have this little series called Forerunners, which is meant to be sort of works in progress, works that are provocative, and also meant to be something that's not so academic, that is intended for a larger public. So what I love about this press is that you can read the book online for free, and it's sort of more accessible than a lot of scholarly presses tend to be. So I was so happy when they accepted our little manuscript.
So just rewinding a little bit, when you talk about petroculture, I think it'd be interesting to dig into this a bit, as a starting point of critique, because there is, and a lot of different people will be hearing this interview in different places. So I think there's an understanding of the ways that oil and gas are contributing to climate change. And, there's a lot of, justified worry about that. So can you connect that with this idea of the cultural influence of oil and gas in terms of what you're critiquing, right? Because there's the material dependency, but there's also an effect on cultures, and whether it's in North America, Turtle Island, or around the world. And I think having that initial sort of understanding is important.
Yeah, absolutely. So I should preface this by saying I am not an expert on petrocultures. I'm not a part of this big collective. I was involved in this side project, but I'm not someone who works on petroculture. So my answer will be kind of basic. There are people like Darren or Imre Zeman or the other organizers of the conference are definitely better placed to talk about this. But quickly, the idea is that any systems of power, including obviously energy, have a deep cultural signification. So, while oil has a primary role to play in industry or automobiles or things like that, it's not limited to fuel. It seeps into cultural imaginary, into kind of artistic production, into movies, films, books, things like that. Not only in terms of appearing as represented in these things, but also film itself materially is made from plastic, which is again a petrochemical product. Similarly, cassette tapes or something like that. So it's actually in our world the way that it is right now. It's impossible to separate the material realities of petrol or oil from all of our cultural production, both in terms of representation as well as materiality. So I think that's what petrocultures as a whole responds to, right? You can't actually imagine oil painting without some sort of petrochemical process. So things like that are what scholars who work in this large field called petrocultures are responding to. And so when it comes to something like solarity, it's thinking, well, what would a solar culture look like, right? What kinds of ways So for instance, in petrocultures, people talk about a certain kind of way in which governance organizes itself, right? Because of the way that economic power has congealed around oil, or political power has congealed around oil, it requires certain kind of hierarchies and so on, which may or may not be present in a solar culture. Right, you don't really have like a small community-owned oil field, for instance. It usually tends to be big multinational corporations or state corporations that have monopolies over the oil production of a certain place. Whereas with solar, there actually are a lot of examples of both state-owned large-scale solar farms, say in India or China, or increasingly in other parts of the world, as well as small community-owned solar powered villages, or you know, small towns or something like that. So that's one of the reasons why we were interested in this question of what solar might do, because there's some ways in which big solar does sort of mimic big oil, right? In terms of the kinds of social organizings and political groupings that it seems to evoke. In other ways, it doesn't. It disrupts that model. So that's why it was an interesting question to turn to solar.
There's a lot of points to draw from this, so thank you. I think just first of all, when we think about the project of creating solar energy alternatives, one of the things I liked in this book was that I could really feel sort of almost the... Why I like the texts where you were describing the relationship between the sun and the earth, and sort of like the sort of material reality of, like, not in terms of product, but in terms of earth as a place in the universe and the sun. And sort of like, I just liked thinking about that on a cultural level, because you talked about like oil culture. And I think a lot of that has been about the disembodied experience, right? Just in terms of people having cultural experiences that are not connected to the earth, or by extension, our place in the solar system. And you sort of talk a bit about, in these texts, you get that sense of like earth in relation to the sun. So could we just go into that a little bit? Because I think it's always important for people to reflect on that, including myself.
Yeah, thanks for that. I think what's interesting about solar is that we have always already been solarian, right? Like, life on Earth as we know it wouldn't be possible without the sun. Like, the sun is the basis of, like, so it already is the fuel. So in some ways, like, when we're thinking about, you know, what would life look like on Earth powered by the sun, it's like, well, we've already always known it. So there's something kind of basic about turning to the sun, like there's something almost elemental about it, because we already have a relationship with the sun everywhere on Earth, right? Sometimes it's a relationship of I don't know, like, not enough sun at certain times of the year, or sort of a relationship of the absence of sun where there's a lot of darkness, or a relationship of too much sun, especially now with climate change, where you have increasingly heat waves around the world. But then obviously our world is so structured right now by agriculture. So in many ways, that's like the original harnessing of solar energy, if you think about it, in terms of like a human powered, you know, kind of gathering of solar energy and storing it or consuming it later or something like that. Like, there's a way in which agriculture functions in many, you know, instances as a kind of a battery, right? Or you could think about it like that. But it also, it invites us to, you know, bask in it, the sun, I mean. It invites us to run from it, to shelter from it. So the sun has already pervaded cultural imagination from the beginning, right? Of any kind of recorded cultural history around the globe. So I find that fascinating, is it's not turning to something new, something that's technologically novel, or it is, but not only that, right? So like solar panels are storing, you know, having these massive solar fields, you know, where you witness a kind of a technological, the prowess of, you know, India or China. I keep thinking of those two because they have such, like, the scale is so grand and they're trying to kind of claim a kind of a leadership in solar, in the globe. So I keep thinking of those because those images pop up to me. But around the world, people are implementing these massive solar fields, like in deserts and so on. So you do have the kind of novelty and newness and innovation, you know, and technological prowess part of it. But you also have this kind of basic elemental need for the sun, right? Like, we literally cannot survive without the sun. Or like the world as we know it, life on Earth would not be the way it is without the sun. So there's something both that's so like known to us, that's so intimately a part of us, and then some, and so it becomes something that feels like you naturally turn towards it as a replacement for fossil fuels. But obviously that comes with other questions, you know, because solar panels aren't grown, they're made, and they're made with materials that are mined from the earth. So again, that's another like connection with the earth and the sun, is like we do need mediating infrastructures, and those infrastructures are made out of materials that require very similar extractive processes to petrocultures, right? So it maybe not similar, but or they're different, but it still requires extraction, and it can still take on extremely harmful forms. So there, sometimes in literature or even in political speech, when we talk about the sun, sometimes there's a way in which it's like, this is the ultimate clean energy, because the sun's energy is freely received all over Earth, right? And sure, that's true. We don't need that to be mediated, but in order to harness it and store it and power, you know, air conditioners and homes and, you know, internet and so on, that requires mediation. And so, that we need to interrupt, like, both, like, accept the kind of naturalness of the sun, but then interrupt that when it comes to solar fuel.
One thing I think could be important just to hear about is some of the collective actions and projects that you describe in the book. Maybe you could just talk a bit about that.
Yeah, totally. There were two cases that really stood out to us as a group that came up both in the summer school, and then we felt like they had to be mentioned here. So one of them is the Pitapan solar project, I guess. I forget the exact name of it, but it's in an indigenous, maybe I can find actual text so that I'm not misrepresenting it in any way. Sorry, just give me a second. Yeah, so it's this Pitapan solar project in Little Buffalo, Alberta. So one thing that's amazing about it is that it's occurring in the kind of heart of petrocultures in Canada, in Alberta, very close to where the tar sands are. So so that's interesting to find, like, the flourishing of something like a solar project right where people say you must mine for more petrochemicals, right? And so this particular project was launched by the Lubicon Lake Band, which is a Cree-speaking community in the village of Little Buffalo, Alberta. And it's only about a five-hour drive from Edmonton. And so we had a representative, Melina Labucan Massimo, who's the founder of Sacred Earth Solar. And she's a member of the community who together they decided to implement a solar energy field or project in their home. And I guess what's really interesting about it is that the members of the community not only came together to decide to put it there, but where to put it, then were trained in the maintenance and running of the solar project and continue to kind of own it, right? So it's bringing self-reliance to the community, not only in terms of the energy that it's producing, but also in terms of like being not relying on the grid, right? And being able to run all of the components of the solar project by themselves. I thought that was, or all of us were very interested by that, because it's this bringing this possibility of energy justice. So justice in its most kind of capacious sense, where it's not only about being ecologically cleaner or better, but also about being socially and politically more just, more egalitarian, more inclusive, right? And bringing power to people who have traditionally been oppressed and been kind of cut away, you know, have that power taken away from them in multiple ways, both in terms of actual energy fuel, but also otherwise. So that was one of the major projects. The other one that I'm not sure we talk about that deeply in this book, because it's been written about so extensively, is called Solidarity, and it's in a Black community in the U.S. where the community decided to replace, like, it was kind of notorious for being kind of unsafe, I guess, after dark. And so the community replaced all of the street lighting by solar, which seems a fairly simple thing, but it really altered their relationship to their own homes, right? It made it, again, community-owned, community-run, and it was the community doing something for the betterment of themselves. So it's, again, this, like, sense of self-reliance. So, those are the kind of positive possibilities of solar, I think, especially when you have small-scale, community-owned and community-run solar projects. It gives you a real sense of how that can shift the relationship with state power or just, like, kind of empower oppressed communities, right? So I think that that's... Those were really positive examples for us to turn to. And then there's another one in the book that I think is worth kind of juxtaposing to these, which is a solar project in India. There was this news article that came out that kind of showed how villagers were, I portrayed them as being superstitious and basically just like illiterate people not knowing what they're doing and breaking solar panels, right? And as it turned out, the news was basically misrepresenting them. The reason that the villagers were breaking the solar panel was not due to superstition, but because the panels required vast amounts of water to keep them clean, because as soon as you have dust or dirt on a solar panel, it greatly reduces the amount of energy that is captured. So this was a state-run solar project in a village in India that was put there without their consent, right? Without their prior consent. And required the diversion of big amounts of irrigation water, water intended for irrigation. So the villagers, who are mostly farmers, broke the solar panels because they said that the solar project was diverting water away from their fields, and the project wasn't giving energy back to the village where it was situated. Instead, the energy was being redirected elsewhere. So I think like that's a really kind of important, or like it's a very illustrative example of the ways in which solar can go, can actually reproduce a lot of the problematic, oppressive, and just belittling, environmentally destructive tendencies that we see in petrocultures. So it's not that because solar is cleaner as a fuel that it's necessarily cleaner. Because solar is cleaner when it comes to the earth, that it's necessarily cleaner when we harness it.
That has been a conversation with Aisha Vermouri, who co-edited a book called Solarity, Seeking Energy Justice. And it was put together by a collective of people, After Oil Collective. It included many contributions. You can find that book. There's a free PDF download, and also it is a physical book, which you can order from the University of Minnesota Press. I will put the link in the description of the program, which you can find on our archives at soundcloud.com/freecityradio. Free City Radio is hosted and produced by me, Stefan Christoph, and we air on CKUT 90.3 FM in Montreal at 11 a.m. on Wednesdays, on CJLO 1690 a.m. in Geoghegan, Montreal on Tuesdays at 1 p.m., on CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg at 10:30 p.m. on Tuesdays, on CFRC 101.9 FM in Kingston, Ontario at 11:30 a.m. on Wednesdays, on CFUV 101.9 FM in Victoria, BC on Wednesdays at 9 a.m. and Saturdays at 7 a.m. on Met Radio, 1280 a.m. in Toronto at 5:30 a.m. on Fridays, and on CKCU, 93.1 FM in Ottawa on Tuesdays at 2 p.m. We are also a podcast. Look us up on Spotify or Apple Podcasts. Thanks so much for being with us, and I will speak to you next week.
You're listening to CKUT. The following is a previously broadcast program. Stay tuned.
F-Files
Radio.
Exploring feminism and technology through space and time.
Ecology, oh.